Hello, welcome to Dyslexia Explored. I am looking forward to this episode. Today I have got the founder and executive of Noticeability. He's a restaurateur of old. He's involved in nonprofits, and he believes that the benefits of dyslexia far outweigh the challenges. He's also the father of a teen with dyslexia, and he's dyslexic himself. I'd really looking forward to introducing you to Dean Bragonier. It's great to have you here, Dean.
Darius, I'm stoked to be on your podcast. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's going to be great to hear your story. People might have seen some of the talks that you've given. You've done a TEDx talks on dyslexia that's been listened to quite a few times, and you run a company called Noticeability that helps children with dyslexia tap into their entrepreneurial spirit. That really helps dyslexic kids. Can you explain to us a little bit about Noticeability, just so that people have got like a frame of reference of what you're doing right now?
Absolutely, absolutely. So Noticeability, or No Disability, as you may hear it, is a nonprofit organization that I founded here in the United States five and a half years ago. The mission is very straightforward. We are focused on introducing middle school age children to the cognitive advantages associated with the dyslexic mind. And the whole reason behind this is because when a student has been bombarded with this negative feedback loop for the first 12 years of their lives, when they fail perpetually in school, they start to internalize that as a larger narrative of their self-worth. Much later in life, most dyslexics discover what these cognitive advantages look like and start to address that malignant self-esteem that they formulated when they were children. Our thesis is that if you can introduce those children to these dyslexic advantages when they are midstream in their academic process, they can start to rebuild their self-esteem and bolster academic tenacity, one's willingness to stick with academics when they get difficult. And in the big picture, start to reduce some of those horrific statistics that follow dyslexics in terms of school attrition and incarceration, drug and alcohol abuse. So it's simple. We introduce kids to what they're good at so they can start to feel better about themselves. And the hope is that we can start eroding some of those negative outcomes that often haunt our population.
Fantastic, Dean. Fantastic. We've interviewed professionals in all sorts of different fields. It's really fascinating to hear people's stories right from where you want to start the story. So where would you start the story before you became aware of dyslexia in your life? What was life like? Paint the picture, set the scene, and then tell us what woke you up to dyslexia.
You know, I think that I think I should be forthright in saying that I was very fortunate. And by that, I mean this. I was born into a family where my father understood he had dyslexia. I was born into a family where my mother was a child developmental psychologist. So if you could ask for two parents who were sort of predisposed to recognize my challenges, I had that benefit. Wow. Now, yeah, right. Remarkable. Now, I was born in 1973, which is feels like a lifetime ago as I stare in the mirror and see all the gray hair on my face. But the idea was that 1973, very, very few people even recognized, let alone had the ability to get a proper diagnosis. So again, that fed into that very fortunate circumstance in which I was born. And I also want to be very, very frank and transparent about the fact that, you know, as a citizen of the United States, I'm a white male, which unfortunately brings with it a certain privilege that others don't have. And quite frankly, I had a family that had the you know, sufficient resources to get me a diagnosis and then to get me the reading remediation I needed and to put me into educational
facilities where I had the attention. I mean, what we would call here in the United States, private schooling. So I had it all the benefits that one could ask for when it comes to dyslexia. However, and this is the catalyst of the work that I do, it didn't provide me with an immunity to how I felt about myself.
Wow.
And that's something I don't think that many of us in the professional sort of field where we're focused on either research or reading remediation or best methodology, I think there's far too little attention paid to how a child feels about themselves, even if they were to get the benefits that I did.
Okay. So what was the wake up call for you? You know, what actually woke you up to dyslexia? Was it really early? What was that turning point?
You know, Darius, I think that I can't speak to a specific moment, but what I can speak to is a sort of an unfolding epiphany that I had. And I suppose it was around first or second grade here in the United States, which probably puts me around 6-7 years old. And you know, until that point, you know, life had been, you know, quite wonderful, right? I mean, you know, minus the scraped knees and the bruised bones, life was very easy. I excelled in, you know, finger painting like everybody else. And then they introduced the first litmus test of intelligence, which was, can I learn how to read? And I had this moment almost like where you sort of wake up after getting hit in the head during sports or something, and you sort of shake your head loose and reality sort of has a moment to settle in. The picture doesn't look exactly like it did the moment before you were tackled. And I remember being in that sort of perpetual state for an extended period of time saying, wait a minute, what's going on here? All my little peers were crushing it. They were having no problem, you know, reading DOG and pronouncing things and spelling things correctly. And I was like, absolutely not getting it. I was like, you know, I was like the record that was sort of skipping. I was just missing something. And the assumptions of, you know, life being, you know, this skipping down some lollipop lane, all of a sudden, you know, I was questioning the hubris of the assumption that life was going to be effortless, and getting as a result sort of that cold sweat moment where you start to look around you with widened eyes, asking yourself, what the heck is going on? And then what starts is the feedback loop. You're terrified, you're sweating, you don't know what's going on. And then little Jimmy or Susie next to you goes, what's your problem? Why can't you read it? It's dog, dummy. It's hat, dummy. Or the teacher says to you, I think you just need to work harder. I think you really need to apply yourself. And you look up, right, with those sort of deer in the headlight eyes at the teacher going, is my attention that I am expelling upon this rote task, is it somehow less effortful than everybody else? I see myself struggling my tail off. How can you tell me that I'm not trying? What is trying then? Do I have to be bleeding to prove that I'm trying? Yeah. And so I think it was a period of months and perhaps, a year where I just started re-questioning a lot of my assumptions and coming to a pretty dark conclusion that I was the toy that came off the assembly line a bit broken.
Yeah. Yeah. That's quite a picture, isn't it? The toy that came off the assembly line a bit broken. It's like a Toy Story, the beginning of a Toy Story movie there.
Yeah. Yeah.
And And I think we can all empathize with that. So what you got given all the resources that every parent would love to give their child, or every parent would like to see their child get, by the sounds of it. And yet it was a challenge for you as well. And what I love to find out is everyone's kind of picks up a different nuance of the challenges that dyslexia throws at you. What would you say is yours then? I think you've alluded to it, but you know, what was the main challenge you faced? Let's say in your sort of teenage years, 8 to 12 is a real interest to our audience, you know. What and then teenage years and so on. What was your main challenge, would you say, that you faced?
Well, the main challenge that I was wrestling with, and I'd be lying to you if I said it wasn't something I still wrestle with to this day, is acceptance. I was seeing very vividly that I was not being accepted for who I was in my peer group. I was not being accepted by the teachers who were trying to teach me. I was not being accepted by myself because, once again, I was painfully aware of the fact that I was insufficient. And, you know, you enter the teenage years and, you know, the hormones start to kick in and hair sprouts from different parts of your body and weird psychological things start happening as a result of brain chemistry. And it is arguably the time when very few people feel accepted.
Yeah.
But you augment that with this haunting picture of oneself that it's not, you don't even have the luxury of feeling awkward about your body shape or your physicality, because you have so much bigger fish to fry, which is psychologically, mentally, intellectually, you don't feel like you should be sitting at the right table. You're not sitting at the right table. You're being shuffled off into, again, under ideal circumstances, into a room. It used to be a little room with little desks with little chairs and no windows. It's changed a little bit, not much. And you go off to get tinkered with while the rest of your peers go out to kick a ball at recess.
Yeah.
And the inability to accept yourself is a direct relationship, a direct reflection to the fact that you're exterior circumstances, your peer group, the adult figures in your life aren't accepting of you. And I don't care how much resolve you may have as a 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12-year-old kid, there's no way you're going to be able to say, well, these are simply adults who haven't been trained in what dyslexia is, and they don't understand the phonological challenge. It's nonsense. There's no way a kid is going to be able to buffer themselves from that feedback loop. And so you start to internalize it. And I often describe my self-esteem as being malignant, right? You get into what we call sixth or seventh grade, the workload increases. You've got all these social issues and pressures and anxieties. And then teachers say, great, time to drop 2, 3, 4x the amount of work on you because we've got to prepare you for high school. And you go, whoa, I wasn't able to get my head above water with the workload that I was dealing with previously.
Yeah.
And so that feedback loop kicks in at a higher level. And what's very scary is that if you believe that you are worthless and you can't carve out an identity, and I refer to athletes, dyslexic athletes, as one of the few groups that is able to thread the needle successfully because they have an identity of being an athlete. But if you're not an athlete, you're going to conclude that you're not smart, you're not an intellect, you're not an academic person, and you're not an athlete, which means that when Jimmy and Susie say, let's go behind the bleachers after school drink some beers, you think, well, all I have to do is open a can and consume, and I'm accepted into that group. And so you start to gravitate towards groups that are less than savory, probably because they're dealing with their own issues. But you start to look for ways to medicate your malignant self-esteem. And I think, you know, it needn't be drugs, alcohol. It can be certain behaviors. It can be other forms of addiction that allow us to turn a blind eye to the psychological impact that we've been dealing with now at that point for upwards of a decade. And that's where danger is at our doorstep. And it terrifies me.
Yeah. How eloquently put, Dean. I think I wasn't expecting you to say acceptance. That's a powerful way of describing it. And even self-acceptance.
Well, you know, I mean, this is turning into a therapy session, Darius. You know, you're going to have to send me your medical copay. Remember, we don't have subsidized healthcare like you do. So you're going to have to send me my bill after this. But yeah, I'm being facetious, but the reality is that somebody has to talk about what this is like. And, you know, you've interviewed some really amazing, accomplished dyslexics, and I have the honor of meeting them on a daily basis. And one of the things that fails to amaze me is that no matter how accomplished they are, almost every single one of them harbors some concern about their self-worth. And it's amazing. They may get up from a meeting with me and jump into their private aircraft and go to their private island, yet there's still a vulnerability deep down inside of them that somehow they don't belong at the table. And that couldn't be more wrong and accurate, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
And that's absolutely why I want to focus on how the child feels about themselves. We need to get them that diagnosis. We need to get them the We need them to get the skills that Bullet Map share with them. But we also need to think about how they feel about themselves going through this process. Because if they get all those assets, yet still wind up feeling like a shell of a human being, they're not going to be empowered people. And you need to look no further than my story. I had every benefit and zero sense of self-worth.
Wow.
So what's it doing to those that don't get that benefit?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I was thinking this today about 40% of people are entrepreneurs, 30 to 40% of entrepreneurs are dyslexic. The other statistic is, 40% of folk in jail are dyslexic as well. But that doesn't mean 40% of all dyslexics are entrepreneurs. It's actually, if you look at the proportion of dyslexic thinkers that are entrepreneurs, I imagine it's much smaller in proportion to the amount of people who have dyslexia. And often it's easy to slip into the thinking that, oh, well, I'll just become an entrepreneur or something like that. When I see a lot of kids who are like, actually, I want to be a nurse. I want to be a physiotherapist or an ambulance driver or a paramedic, and all of these require some degree of, you know, passing a test or, you know, showing your aptitude and so on. And the confidence ends up becoming as much of a blocker as the lack of grades for a lot of these things.
Yeah.
So that was your challenge. And what do you think has been the reward you've got from facing that challenge?
Well, there's a lot. I mean, there's a lot, without a doubt. But, you know, hands down, the greatest benefit that I have been given as a result of facing these challenges, addressing these emotions, and using a bit of of business methodology that I learned early in the hospitality industry is that I can be of service now. And I, you know, in the nonprofit world in the United States, it's not a glamorous world. It's you're, for the most part, you're underpaid and underappreciated. But what happens is you get to exist in a world where the currency, if you will, is gratitude. And when I am able to speak to an audience or when I get to work with students who go through our curriculum, there is an undying sense of gratitude. And for me to allow my story to be a in some ways, you know, a warning sign, in some ways, an empowerment tool, whatever it may be, the hardships and the challenges that I faced can now be assets to those who are younger than me. And that gratitude that I feel when somebody finds something I say or something that we've created of value makes me realize that I've got a seat at a table, and that table is filled with dyslexics. And when I meet dyslexics, when I speak with dyslexics, I honestly recognize, and I say this somewhat facetiously, but somewhat seriously, that I'm a dyslexic elitist. Like, I freaking love dyslexics. I think they're the most brilliant freaking people on earth. Their stories are fascinating because they've experienced adversity. They have hopefully persevered. Many do not, unfortunately, and that's what we need to remedy. But they have these brains that are so far outside of the box. I get on a call with a fellow dyslexic and I strap on my metaphorical seatbelt because I know that we're going to get launched into the stratosphere.
Yeah.
No matter what happens.
Yeah, yeah, and absolutely.
Man, am I go back to acceptance and the self of belonging. I'm so honored to be a part of this tribe. I can't even get over it.
Yeah.
And so that is the benefit of all of it. That's the benefit. And selfishly, well, I'll go into my family later, but.
Oh, well, no, go for it. You know, your family, you know, rewards. Talk about your family then.
Well, you know, I fell in love with this woman that, not surprisingly, is dyslexic. And she's an extraordinary artist. I mean, you know, her diversity of artistic expression and talent is mind-boggling. It really, really is, and I mean that sincerely. And you know, I think it was the first date we ever went on, we both identified ourselves as being dyslexic, and it kind of came as no surprise because, you know, we were getting along really well. So, you know, We got married, had a child, and knew that statistically he was going to be a dyslexic purebred, right? He was like, he was getting it from both sides of the lineage. And, yeah, you know, the U.S. government wasn't going to be able to create a more, you know, dyslexified DNA strain than this kid was going to get. And so, you know, the idea was, well, you know, for anybody who's a parent, you know, the moment you watch your partner give birth or you have just given birth, your whole paradigm shifts, right? You all of a sudden, for me, it was like, oh, thank God, I'm no longer the center of my own universe, right? Here's this kid and all my time and attention is devoted to him. But I also had this, again, an epiphany, and this one wasn't a good one, where I realized, oh my gosh, wait a minute, this kid's gonna be dyslexic and he's going to have this brilliant mind, but he's got to get through like 12 to 16 years worth of education before he's able to really exercise it. And what's going to be able to happen, what unfortunately is going to happen during that interim is he's going to be bashed and beaten by a system that is as antiquated as, you know, as lighting a candle to illuminate your home. I mean, the educational system was going to potentially do to him what it did to me and what it did to my wife. And I felt this responsibility fall onto my shoulders, where I was going to do one of two things. I was going to either stick my head in the sand and simply pretend it wasn't going to happen. I was going to potentially put on the armor and unsheath the sword and say, I'm going to go in, I'm going to slash down anybody that tells me that my kid isn't capable, or I'm going to be able to harness a little bit of what I learned as a young entrepreneur in the hospitality industry, some of the lessons learned from my educational system, and harness that in the educational technology that is now ubiquitous, and blend it with some of the best practices of special education, and furthermore contextualize learning based on the cognitive advantages that I know he has as a result of being dyslexic. And I'm going to put it into four different professional paths where we seem to be disproportionately successful. And the four that I chose, and you said physicians earlier and medics, all of those are very common paths for success with dyslexics. However, the four that we chose was entrepreneurship, engineering, architecture, and the arts. These are four very, very popular professions for dyslexics. I thought, well, why on earth should we roll the dice and hope these kids muster enough self-esteem to get through 12 years or 16 years of education and then reveal why their brains are powerful or so powerful and capable in these professions? Why don't we just introduce it to them when they're in the midst of their battle so that they can understand why it is that this rote learning that we shove down their throats is necessary? Because if they now realize they want to be engineers because they took a course, I mean, shameless plug, but they took a course in noticeability that exposed them to engineering, they can say, geometry really matters. Yeah, I'm going to show up and I'm going to kick some butt in my geometry class. Why? Because I know now why I need to go through it. If you take away the context, especially for dyslexic, it just feels like torture.
Well, go do a shameless plug, Dean, to the listeners and explain to them why their kids need to do notes. Go for it. I'd love to hear a shameless plug for noticeability and why your kid needs to do noticeability.
Well, thank you. I mean, look, I believe very strongly in what we do. It's why I go around, begging for spare change to keep the organization running. It's, you know, what we do is essentially this. In the United States, the term social emotional learning is gaining traction. In reality, what social emotional learning is how do we conduct ourselves in group dynamics? How do we harness our strengths and bolster our weaknesses? How do we engage in conflict resolution and negotiation? And basically, how do we learn how to be psychologically functioning members of society? And that terminology, that area of focus, I think is critical for the dyslexic, because so many of us harbor this animosity towards the system. We have resentment towards people who have, you know, rightful resentment as far as I'm concerned, who have told us we're not capable. And sort of our self-perception needs a sort of a chiropractic adjustment. And so what I wanted to do was focus on a way to address those issues, to give students the ability to understand their self-worth while bolstering what I referred to earlier as academic tenacity, so that they would feel more inclined to stick with school when school got tough. And lastly, how to address stigma consciousness, right? How does a student impose a stigma upon themselves, or more or equally as important, how do adults, peers, stigmatize them as students with dyslexia? So if you can address self-esteem, academic and tenacity, and stigma consciousness, I postulated that we will get a more empowered student as a result. Now, the other thing that I mentioned was that there is a set of cognitive advantages, which, like everything else, vary on the individual student with dyslexia, but have been revealed through a book called The Dyslexic Advantage. Now, The Dyslexic Advantage talks about this portfolio of sort of cognitive assets and then goes on to translate how those assets apply to certain professional paths. And while they are sort of leaders in this strength-based approach, it is being reinforced by researchers around the world that these certain aspects of the dyslexic advantage are real. And so what better way to re-engage a disenfranchised learner than to be the first one that says, oh, by the way, that thing that you think is so awful, your dyslexia, actually has advantages. And let me share with you certain exercises that will demonstrate to you irrefutably, that these advantages exist. And the last sort of intersecting circle in that Venn diagram is those professions that we have chosen, again, a small sampling of a vast spectrum of professions where dyslexics succeed. But the four that we have chosen, distilling those professional disciplines to an age-appropriate level, using that as context through which to allow these students to understand what they're good at. And one of the things that the authors describe in The Dyslexic Advantage is something called the 700 Club. And this sort of epitomizes what it is that we do. In the United States, we have this rudimentary intelligence test. It's a standardized test for college admissions. I think in the UK, it's O levels or A levels or Z levels, whatever it is. But what you need to do is take this grueling intelligence test or achievement test to determine which colleges are more inclined to accept you or reject you.
Yeah.
And the cumulative score here in the United States is 1,600. The authors sit down with a handful of individuals. I'm talking those executives who are the titans of industry, right? The global entrepreneurs, et cetera, who have all achieved a score of 700 or less.
So they've got less than half of that test.
They got less than half. And apparently, if you fill out your name correctly, you get upwards of like 300 or 400 points. Okay. And the authors say, hey, with all due respect, okay, how on earth did you change your life trajectory from being somebody who scored less than 700 to being a titan of industry? Their answer is exactly the same. Each one of them can recall with the vividness of watching a movie, the exact time and place that they were, what the sky looked like, what the wind speed was, what the person was wearing in terms of clothing, when they stopped and said, oh, Darius, you're really good at that. That moment, Darius, you're really good at that. Whatever that is, Darius, you're really good at illustrating. Or Darius, you have an incredible ability to see solutions when other people don't. That utterance, that verbal articulation of what that child was doing well, propelled these individuals to find a new path in life other than the one that was so predetermined by these rudimentary intelligence exams or achievement exams, skewed their life into this positive light. So what noticeability is essentially trying to do is recognize that those people may have been very fortunate to have an aunt or an uncle or a coach or a parent or to recognize and articulate what they were good at, but not every dyslexic does. Your audience obviously does. These are parents who care desperately and are probably providing that positive affirmation, but not all kids do. And so what we tried to do is we tried to create a systemic delivery of curriculum that would allow those students to have their own 700 Club moment and flip the switch, which can never be turned off. That's what we do.
700 Club moment. Fantastic. Actually, if you're listening to this, Dr. Fernette Eade, the author, one of the authors of The Dyslexic Advantage, was on the podcast, episode 90. Check it out and see what she has to say about her story behind Dyslexic Advantage. It's fascinating. This podcast is sponsored by DyslexiaProductivityCoaching.com, which helps you organize yourself creatively with a productivity system for Apple devices. Dean, let's go on to how you learn. You know, like, I love to find out how, what makes people tick. And I think it's really helpful for other parents and adults with dyslexia to see what influences you, the way you learn. What are your most influential learning moments in that, in your journey? You know, was it a person? Was it a group? Was it a course? What was it that really helps you learn?
So I'm going to go big picture on you, because that's what dyslexics do, right? It's when I gave a crap, when I was interested in something, when I cared about learning something. I will learn it to amateur expert capacity.
Yeah.
Right. If it tickles my funny bone, I am all in, man. I am all in. Now, you throw a bunch of topics you may find interesting that I may not, forget about it. Right. In one ear and out the other. Eyes glaze over, fatigue kicks in, forget about it. But great. If I care, yeah, I'm all in.
Mic drop, Dean. That's fantastic. Yes. Love it.
Oh, you
it's
got
so
that
true.
Over there, do you? Oh, yeah. You guys got the mic drop. Good.
And so what's been your experience of mind mapping in the journey? As you know, I love mind mapping. Is mind mapping part of your life? Is it on your radar? Positive, negative experiences?
Yeah, totally. So mind mapping is certainly, you know, academically speaking, like I've now kind of, what's nice is it, you use a certain technique as an academic tool, and then based on the neuroplasticity of the brain, you start to incorporate those physical tasks with more of a cognitive function. Again, that could be shot full of holes if you speak to a neuroscientist, but that's my belief system. So mind mapping was critical for me when I was a student, because the dyslexic mind, the challenge that we face, as Fernette probably explained, is that it's not that we don't see the answer, it's that we see too many answers, right?
Yeah.
And so it's like, you know, we have this buckshot approach to problems where we've got 1,000 different solutions. And I love what Brock, Fernette's husband, says, is that, you know, we may appear to be slow processors because we're staring out the window thinking of 100 different solutions to the problem that the teacher just proposed to us.
Yeah.
So mind mapping is, for me, was a really, really valuable way for me to start to articulate all of those solutions or all of those topics that I needed to remember. And then, you know, illustrate their interconnectedness, which again is sort of the dyslexic wheelhouse. You know, that evolved. You know, that's one tool in the arsenal. I started to get love the Venn diagrams, right, and the waterfall diagrams, where, you know, Roman Empire, you know, downward to the right arrow leads to Caesar, downward right arrow leads to his dates of reign, down and out. So you get this sort of waterfall diagram where you can remember, okay, Rome, Caesar, boop, 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 boop. Because otherwise, Caesar, Rome, I don't know. I think I saw a movie about it once. It's called like Gladiator, right? I mean, it doesn't have any context, but you make it visual. And then not only is it easier to articulate what I'm thinking, but when I go back to study it, or when I did go back to study it, I could pick up where my mind had left off so that I didn't have to go back to the 100 different solutions. I could focus on the one solution I came up with, and then watch my thought process, which had been illustrated, so that I didn't go down a different wormhole that wasn't applicable to that exam.
Fantastic. Dean, you should come over here and start doing my job, you know?
I need you to help my boy. That's why I'm so excited to be speaking to you. It's like, I love that you have codified this. Maybe that's not the right term, that you have made this into a methodology that is specific to dyslexics, and that you can embed it into a practice, which is critical. Really critical.
Yeah. Well, beautifully explained. So let's go on to advice, the advice section. What advice would you give your teenage self? So here's what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you a card. Okay. And if you want to, you can post it back in time to a certain point in your life. What would it say on the front of the card, and what would it say inside?
On the front, it would say, "You are good enough." And inside, I would probably write something along the lines of, "The hard work will pay off. And one day you'll be able to do twice as much as most in half the time. But always find your passion, because it's meaningless if you don't have a reason." And that goes back, if I may, I'm just seeing the connection right now to you know, dyslexics, we don't read many books, right? Or so at least this dyslexic doesn't like to read unless I have to. But so I gravitate towards short books, obviously, and one that it changed everything for me, or better yet, articulated with such beauty and horror the essence of the human existence was Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl, who is an Auschwitz survivor. And in that book, Mr. Frankl discusses the psychological state of different prisoners and those that were able to survive the circumstances and those who weren't. And he points to those that were able to mentally and emotionally survive the prison camps as having found purpose. That was the distinction, was the moment that a sense of purpose is lost, the odds of survival diminished, bastardizing his eloquence. But without purpose, for this dyslexic at least, I was walking in the dark. And when I say walking in the dark, I mean metaphorically, but literally there was many years where my life was marked by profound shame, self-loathing, dark emotional places. And when a dyslexic finds their purpose, and going back to advice, you know, if that purpose is pottery when you're in seventh grade, if that purpose is collecting footy cards, or if that purpose is, you know, coming up with some, you know, innovative paper route that's going to, make you a few bucks on the side, for us as parents to put our personal agendas on the back burner, because let's be honest, we all love our children. We all want our children to succeed. And if we really get honest with ourselves, part of their success, surprisingly or not surprisingly, looks a lot like our definition of success. If we can have the courage to table that a little bit and ask ourselves, where is it that my child loses a sense of time? When do I have to shout to my kid 5 times to come back downstairs for dinner? That is usually the lifeline that your child is going to be able to hang on to. Now, I'm not talking about endless video games. I'm not talking about endless screen time. I'm talking about when they were out there sledding as I look out onto a field full of snow, and they were building jumps and curves and, you know, starting ramps and stuff. And you wanted them to come inside, but they just wouldn't because they were loving it and they were being creative. Well, let's observe that. And let's identify that that is actually kind of an engineer slash architect in the making, right? Those little sledding chutes, right? You gotta incorporate momentum. You've got to incorporate, you know, the bank, right? To make sure the kid doesn't fly off the track, right? That's all budding interest, and it feels good for them. And then what we as adults can do is say, I notice you're really good at that track. That's kind of strangely, that's kind of considered architecture. Have you ever thought about that? Would you like to take an introductory course in architecture?
Yeah.
And the kid's off to the races.
Or engineering. I love that. You know, the sense of purpose, because in effect, what you're doing is doing that with noticeability, helping them find that sense of purpose, the why at the beginning, and then that carries them through the academics. It's fantastic. And that sense of purpose, you know, what makes them lose time, track of time? That's a fascinating indicator to track. And I was just about to ask, what advice would you give yourself as a parent or other parents? And I think you've answered it by saying, you know, keep a track of what helps your child. When your child loses track of time, like I've seen kids lose track of time when they're editing videos on their phone,
mm-hmm.
or, you know, they're drawing or doodling or, you know, all these different things. I think that's a fascinating way of identifying a person's passion, you know, when they lose track of time.
Yeah. Fantastic. Yeah. And I love it. I mean, you know, there's a bunch of eye rolling parents going, TikTok, that's a waste of time. Well, tell that to Steven Spielberg, one of the most successfully dyslexic directors of all time. Right. It's, you know, we still have to keep the, the guardrails up, right? We can't let them down. Well, no, I want to be a TV producer, so I'm going to watch 18 hours straight of YouTube. No, that doesn't fly. We're very good argumentalists, right?
Yeah.
That sounds like a typical dyslexic argument. I love it.
Yes, it does, yeah.
And you could say, wow, I mean, you've got a propensity to negotiate. That's fantastic.
Yeah, that's right.
Something we should feed, but you're not getting TV more.
Yeah. So, That's right. Yeah. Losing a sense of time when it comes to an argument and negotiating. Parents, if you're listening to this and your kid likes editing video, I highly recommend the app called Luma Fusion on the iPhone or iPad. It's incredible. And you can get lost in it. And I'm sure a lot of your kids would really enjoy it. A lot of YouTubers are using that instead of the really expensive programs. Talking about tech, what's in your travel bag? What tools are in your dyslexia journey travel bag? What tools do you use to organize yourself? Do you use techniques, gadgets, apps? What are your go-tos?
So, first of all, one of my go-tos is to ask you, you said Luna Fusion?
Luma, L-U-M-A.
Thank you. One of my go-tos is to take assistive technology advice from people like you and then introduce it to my son to see if he likes it and can use it. But as for me, like I said, 1973 baby, soon to be 48 years old. Some of these tech tools can be more confusing than beneficial. However, you know, I do use as many of them as I can without overwhelming myself. scheduling and time sequencing is always a challenge for everybody, but specifically those with dyslexia. And, I do a big, I take advantage. I mean, it's such a rudimentary tool, but, Google Calendar or the iCalendar or whatever it is. And just simply setting myself reminders. If I've got a board meeting in next week, I'm going to set a reminder, 7 days before to prep materials, 5 days before to send out those materials to the board, 3 days before to familiarize myself with what needs to be said so that I'm prepared, right? I think that whatever tool allows you to, to sort of ground you back to what needs to be done, because Lord knows we love to exist in sort of a quasi-imaginational world where we just see cool solutions and ideas all the time, but we do have to come back and touch the earth and be responsible for our daily lives. So the sequencing of reminders certainly helps. The voice to text is my tagline on my phone email setting is, forgive me for any errors in this email. I use Siri, but I think she's dyslexic.
Brilliant.
Right? Because Siri makes more spelling mistakes than I do. Right?
Oh, fantastic. Siri's so, dyslexic.
I think we're going to, right? No, I said she writes there, and I don't know if she spelled there correctly. I think there's like 85 different words for there. Anyway, I think that voice to text is slowly improving, but is a huge asset to anybody who's alive right now and has dyslexia. I encourage my son to use it. He is a gifted orator at his young, tender age of 13. And I just, when he comes to writing essays, I just say, look, man, he's ironically, he gets on stage with me and gives talks as well. I said, look, just imagine you're speaking to an audience, voice record it, voice to text, and then go back and edit it, right?
Yeah.
And you get less bogged down with sentence construction because you know how to write verbally. It's very easy. You just need to use this tool to get it, written into a physical form or typed into a physical form. I think that the challenge that I face continuously is with technology come certain improvements and certain detriments, which is now anybody can write me an email anytime during the day, and I wake up and I've got 50 of them that I have to wade through, right? And determining which ones require my attention right now, reading them all, there is that, when somebody, and this is great irony, is that somebody writes the executive dyslexic of a dyslexic organization and writes like 8 paragraphs in an email. I'm like, what part of this don't you understand, right? Give it to me in 3 sentences, I'll respond, but 8 paragraphs, forget about it. But if I have to, then all of a sudden I'm doing text to speech, right? Highlighting that. So these are all rudimentary. There are so many amazing tools out there. But Learning Ally is one that translates a lot of textbooks into speech, into spoken word. These are assets that this old man uses, let alone, assistive technology experts in the field who would put me to shame, who have forgotten more about AT than I will ever know.
Fantastic, Dean, it's just been brilliant hearing your story all in one go. Let's wind things up. And is there anything else you'd like to add? Or, well, first I'll get you to share various links in a minute, but anything else you'd like to cover that we haven't covered?
Darius, I think anybody who's listened to this to the full extent is probably hoping I don't speak more. And so I'm going to reward them and say, no, we covered it, man. We're good.
The amount, of people who get in touch with me and say, I've listened to every minute of every episode.
Oh yeah. There may not be many that say that after this one. They're like, gosh, you got to mute that guy, man.
No, it's been good, Dean. It's been good. So we will put Dean's links in the description. So where should people go to connect with you and Noticeability?
Sure. You can find us at noticeability.org. That's critical. I think that if you put in no disability, it'll still come to us. I think I got both those domains. Just an FYI, because it's a question that we often get. Can my school use your curriculum? Yes. Can my homeschooling association? Yes. Can my private tutoring practice? Yes. Can I sign up my child remote learning? Yes. We have groups of kids literally from all over the world, except we don't have any Scots, and I'm hoping that you can help us correct that.
Oh, well, yeah, I'll see what I can do about that.
Yeah, good. But what's amazing is bringing kids in four-person groups into video conferencing platforms where they can meet each other, where they can explore their strengths, where they can bond and have friendships based on common struggle and common assets is extraordinary. And it doesn't matter what country they come from, provided they can speak English, although we do have courses that operate in foreign languages but are not facilitated by our home office. Shameless plug, enough of that. Thank you.
Brilliant, Dean. Brilliant. We'll put that in the links below. It's fascinating. I've got a number of students who do Noticeability that are also part of Bullet Map Academy. And what one of the things that you do that very few other people do, and we do as well, is we get our students together in little study groups. And you do that Noticeability and they share their ideas with each other and they go on a little journey together. And that there's something very powerful about doing that that makes you not feel alone. It's not a head thing. It's a heart thing and really feeds the soul. So great move there, Dean. We've seen huge benefits of that over the last 3-4 years, too.
The moment that I can go to bed feeling like I did something decent in the world is when I get the emails from parents after the class has ended and saying, hey, do we have your permission for our kids to continue their Zoom meetings together?
Yes.
Great. And I go, heck yeah, man. That's the whole point.
Yeah.
Yeah. Have at it. That's awesome. That's friendship. That's belonging. That's acceptance.
That's brilliant. Thank you, Dean. So if you're listening to this, hope you have a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. And we've got a lot more podcasts lined up for you in the new year. Dean, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Darius. Keep doing what you're doing, man. It's great to have a brother over there.
And when you come over to Scotland and stop by in Edinburgh, I'll show you around Edinburgh, the castle, the Holyrood Park, the Royal Mile, and so on.
Well, we're so there, man. Thank you. We'll see you soon.
This podcast is sponsored by DyslexiaProductivityCoaching.com. It's my day job when I'm not hosting this podcast. Tell me, do you know what you want to achieve in the workplace, but you're struggling with how to achieve it? Maybe you suspect some traits of dyslexia are getting in the way. Well, that's where Dyslexia Productivity Coaching comes in, because we give you a simple productivity system for your Apple devices that harnesses the creativity that comes with your dyslexia. It includes proven methods like note-taking, reminders, speech-to-text, mind mapping, and more, all tailored to your needs. It'll free up your time and help you achieve outstanding results. Book a complimentary call to discuss it with me, and if you do it soon, I may also be available to coach you personally via Zoom. So don't be shy, go to dyslexiaproductivitycoaching.com or swipe up and book it now.